Okay, good morning, everyone. This hearing of the House Tribal Affairs Committee will now come to order. The time is 8:04 a.m. Thursday, February 12th, 2026, in Capitol Room 106. Members present are from the House Tribal Affairs, Representative Schwanke, Representative Freer, Representative Carrick. Good morning, and myself, Chair Dybert. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. And a quick reminder to please silence your cell phones. Before we begin, I would like to thank Jordan Nicholson, the Tribal Affairs Secretary from Records, and Emily Mesh from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today and keeping us going smoothly. Before we get into our agenda, I'd like to remind the committee that we will have a hard stop today at 9:30 for another meeting that I need to go to. Introductions. We have one item on the agenda today. We will be hearing a presentation from the Food Bank of Alaska. We're joined in the committee room today by Chief Advocacy Officer Rachel Miller and Chief Programs Officer Anthony Reinhart, who will be providing an update on the Food Bank's statewide services and rural programs. Mrs. Miller and Mr. Reinhart, welcome to the Tribal Affairs. Please join us at the table and put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. For the record, my name is Rachel Miller. I'm the Chief Advocacy Officer for Food Bank of Alaska.
Thank you so much. For the record, my name is Anthony Reinhart, Chief Programs Officer at Food Bank of Alaska.
Is this go time?
It is, okay. Yeah. And you're only thing on the agenda, so I think we'll have plenty of time for questions as we go along. All right, perfect. Please proceed.
Great. Well, good morning again. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your interest in our anti-hunger work across the state. Food Bank of Alaska has been working in the state to end hunger since 1979, and we are still here, which means there is still work to do. So this morning, we'd like to share with you what we do at Food Bank of Alaska, how our model works. We'll talk a little bit about our partners and specifically how we serve rural Alaska. I'm joined by Chief Programs Officer Anthony Reinhart, and we'll talk a little bit about our organization first. Got all the tools. Excuse me. So we'll kick off with some numbers around the scope and scale of what we do. Food Bank of Alaska is just that. It is a bank. We bring food in, we send food out, and ideally it gets to our end users, which are our clients. They are all of our neighbors, as expeditiously as possible and as cost effectively as possible. We have a variety of programs that Anthony will talk about in a second, but just to highlight some numbers, to set the baseline, 1 in 7 Alaskans experience hunger, and that means 1 in 5 kids experience hunger. Our mission is to end that, and it takes a lot of people to do that. So what we do is work with an anti-hunger network around the state, and that includes over 150 organizational partners who do direct service to clients or our neighbors, and that includes 185 rural communities. Last year, we distributed over 10 million pounds of food, and that was 8.2 million meals provided. You know that we have not a lot of road miles in Alaska, and so a lot of our work happens far beyond the end of the road. And Anthony can highlight what that means in cost, in time to serve, and some of the challenges that we all have experienced just by living up here. We all know what our supply chain looks like and means and how it affects us. So I'll turn it over to Anthony to talk about this big list of work that we do.
All right, thank you, Rachel. Again, my name is Anthony, and I operate the programmatic side of Food Bank of Alaska with a team of 9. Food Bank has been growing over our time operating, and we're now almost up to 50 employees, which is incredible. We also have a new facility that's allowing us to reach more corners of the state than we ever have before. We operate about a dozen programs, some of them highlighted on the screen, many of them focused on finding ways to efficiently move food out to rural Alaska. As noted, and as we all know, challenges of serving our neighbors in rural Alaska are many and great, and they also oftentimes experience higher rates of food insecurity and more acute instances of hunger than we see in our road system neighbors. We operate a number of programs that target specifically either times of year or certain populations of neighbors to be able to make sure that our most vulnerable are reached. And I'll highlight a couple here. We work with our state and federal partners to administer the Summer Food Service Program, which covers children's meals over the summer when there's a gap in school meals. We're really excited about our work in the last several years on a program called Meals to You, which is a subset of the Summer Food Service Program. Meals to You, we have a slide coming up, but just a preface, is an incredible way of getting food directly to households in rural Alaska, and it's doing exactly what it was designed for. We'll talk a little bit more about it later. We also operate a program called the Commodity Supplemental Food Program. You'll hear maybe some acronyms, and that is kind of commonly known as the Senior Box Program, and it's nutrition dedicated to seniors in our state. We operate commodity food programs, TFAP being one of them, the Emergency Food Assistance Program, where we actually bring commodity food up into Alaska and then ship it out to our network of about 65 partners. That is our rural flagship program. We'll also talk more about that later. A big part of our work is rescuing food. So about 60% of the 10 million pounds that we distribute annually comes from food that would otherwise be thrown away. We have a fleet of trucks that rescue that food from grocery stores at the end of its life, and we're able to turn it around very quickly to our neighbors. We work very closely with the SNAP program here in the state, and we have a whole team dedicated to outreach. It's very important because SNAP is our most powerful tool in battling hunger currently. So we send our staff all over the state, making sure that our neighbors have access and supporting them in completing the application. And we're also very excited to talk about some new and upcoming opportunities, food as medicine being one of them, connected to the Rural Health Transformation Funding. But we are piloting some work in that space to provide produce boxes to people suffering from cancer. So that's current, and we're excited to speak more about it.
And then we're going to start to get into some of these programs and to give a little more detail. Questions are welcome. Every question helps us learn a little bit more in how to communicate with you. Something that's important to remember is that Food Bank of Alaska, if you look at the scope or the scale that we distribute at, our food comes from a variety of sources. We, as Anthony said, we do food rescue. The food banking model historically was largely about food rescue and recapture and redistribution to decrease waste in the system and get it to those most in need. We do also increasingly purchase food. So donations from sponsors, donations from individuals are something that it's a key cornerstone of our model. And we also, again, as Anthony said, work with government commodity programs. So this is quite the patchwork quilt of how we make every year happen. And that's why we're really grateful to be down here every year during Food Security Week to speak with all of you. So thank you for your audience.
Thank you so much for this slide. This was a lot to take in. And I have one question. I'll look to the committee if they have others. I really appreciate the mentioning of off the road, on the road, and rural Alaska. Is there a region of the state that is a high need for that you could like highlight for us? Thank you.
Yes, there is, and it is on a handout that is in my bag right there. I would love to stand up and get it.
Absolutely.
Alaska does have some of the highest rates of food insecurity in the nation, and we Food Bank of Alaska is part of a larger network of food banks called the Feeding America Network. It's about 200 partner food banks, us being one of them. Through our network, we're charged with serving the entire state of Alaska, and as mentioned, we do that through a network of partners. Feeding America spends a lot of resources studying hunger to understand where gaps exist. And in fact, the study is called Map the Meal Gap, which is where we get most of our information. But we know that The Kuslavik region of Alaska has the highest rate of food insecurity in the nation.
Wow.
To build on that, every office this week has received some blue folders labeled the Alaska Food Coalition, and in those folders are handouts. One of them is about the state of hunger in Alaska, where, again, we highlight that 1 in 7 Alaskans experience hunger. And there's a map on there with the top five areas with the highest rate of food insecurity, starting at 25% with Kuslavik, and then moving to Bethel at 20.8%, Yukon Koyukuk at 20.1, Nome 18.8, Northwest Arctic 18.5.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It just kind of gives us a broader picture when we talk about food insecurity in Alaska. Before I go to the next question, I'd like the record to reflect at 8:08. We've been joined by Representative Story. Question from Rep. Carrick.
Thank you for being here. Good morning. And through the chair, I just wanted to ask about the Emergency Food Assistance Program a little bit more. How many communities in Alaska right now are receiving food through that program again?
Thank you so much for your question. Through the chair.
Mr. Reinhart.
Currently in Alaska, we have about 70 partners that receive TFAP. That does not mean 70 communities. A handful of them are in Anchorage, also in the Mat-Su. In rural Alaska, we have about 60 communities that receive TFAP commodities directly.
And a follow-up.
And
then I guess, can you give me just a general sense? I know it probably looks different in each of those 60 communities, but just a general sense of what volume of the fresh produce and food is received in those communities on the whole that's coming from the Emergency Food Assistance Program.
Mr. Reiner.
Through the chair. We don't often have opportunities for fresh produce in TFAP. Being a government commodity program, most of the food that we receive is shelf-stable commodities. We do occasionally get grants that allow for the purchase of produce boxes. Unfortunately, those boxes do not travel well, and so we are often forced to turn them around on the road system as opposed to trying to send them out to rural.
Got it. And I have one more
follow-up.
Thank you, through the chair, for the indulgence. I'm just trying to get a sense of what percentage of the volume of food coming into these 60 rural communities served by this program are primarily served by food coming in from this program. And that's, you know, I worry for those communities if a lot of the food that's coming in is through a program called the Emergency Food Assistance Program, because it indicates a different relationship to the food that's coming in than something that's more, that would be named differently. So if you have any comment on that, too.
Do you have a number I can talk to you?
Please.
Ms. Miller?
Sure, thank you. Through the chair. That is a great question. I'm to make sure I understand, are you asking about the total amount of food going to communities and what percentage of that is TFAP?
Yes, and recognizing that all the communities that serve by it are going to look different, and mm-hmm. So there's not a hard and fast answer, I'm sure, but...
Sure. Any idea on the percentage? It would depend.
I'm struggling with the percentage from the standpoint that, not only do we have many, many programs across each community, but also there's a bunch of other food that comes in through grocery stores and other programs. What I can say is that how we determine the amount of food that a community gets is through a ratio based on the size of the community and their overall need. As we receive our percentages from the state of Alaska, we then are able to determine how much of our pile of food can go out to each community. And we do that, like I said, based on need and population.
Thank you. That adds a lot.
Thank you. That's a great question. That's very helpful. Just kind of knowing the picture of food going into a rural community. I'm sure there's grocery stores, there's SNAP, there's the emergency TFEP, and also subsistence, too, in the area, which is very important. Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm curious how much discussion has centered around, so traditional food sources in rural Alaska, it's never been fresh produce, right? It's, you know, during the summertime when things grow or when you harvest, then it's the only time that you get something fresh, and then the rest of the year is maintained by food preservation. So I'm super curious, after this last summer, I think, when food boxes were delivered out to individual families for kids, I saw a lot of those food boxes, and it was all packaged food, and I can totally understand the shelf stable part of it, and it looked like a lot of it was, in the best attempt that packaged food can be, it was healthy, no sugar added types of things. But those products are very expensive, especially when they're packaged in very small quantities, 8 ounces, right, 10 ounces. So I'm kind of curious if the food bank has worked at all with bulk suppliers and considered the freeze-dried concept. It's such, the technology is really rapidly improving. And so I was just kind of curious if there's an opportunity and even potentially to work with some Alaska growers on produce that's not sold right away. And I'm just kind of curious if you guys have talked about that at all or trying to make that connection with people, because when you go out to any of the rural villages, the vast amount of food that is preserved, even in my own house, in my own pantry, in my freezer, there's things that are smoked, there's things that are dried, there's things, you know, that were cured, there's things that were preserved in a lot of different ways, canned, jarred, freeze-dried. I mean, it's the more variety that someone can have in their home on these shelf-stable wild foods, then the less reliant they are on some monthly or regular deliveries of, like Ms. Kerr pointed out, I mean, if it's under an emergency food program, that's frightening, you know, a little bit. So can you describe maybe any efforts and discussion that's centered around kind of preservation of wild foods?
Thank you, through the chair. What a great question, and what an entree into talking about our entire food system in the state. And I think it is important to recognize that not all subsistence gathering is captured in the numbers that we have, and that's important to respect. And, you know, there are a lot of people who may be called hunger or fall under the hungry label, and yet they are subsisting and taking care of their own. And I want to recognize that. It is not always a struggle situation, right? There is a very robust subsistence network, and we recognize that. Serving rural and dovetailing that with traditional foods access is something we regularly talk about at Food Bank and respect the enormity of that task. We, for lack of a better term, we don't want to be a bull in a china shop and come in and dictate what anyone would do. Subsistence harvest is so critical at the community level. And so we would never want to commodify a wild harvest. We want to make sure that people feel empowered to supplement what they do with resources we can provide. And we recognize there's a lane and some boundaries there. This goes into bigger conversations around education, around food preservation, and peer-to-peer learning and elder-youth connection and things like that. So we recognize that. I will try and stay in this lane of Food Bank today. I'll talk a little bit more about this as we get further on in the Food as Medicine discussion, which is a nascent initiative right now that we're looking at defining for the entire state, and traditional foods are a part of that.
Quick follow-up? My apologies. I didn't mean to go down the path of, education on that front. I was more actually just considering the fact that when food is purchased in bulk, and if it is bulk purchases of dried foods in particular, or a combination like soup packages, kind of things that are dry that can just be heated, and it's a nutritious meal that's just, a wide variety of foods in one package. I'm just kind of curious if that's an opportunity where we can really get a larger quantity of food at a much lower price.
Through the chair. Thank you so much for this question, because I think it's really important to get into the weeds a little bit. And I believe in the initial question, we're discussing the Meals to You program, the boxes that arrive to our rural neighbors directly to their homes. And I want to just reference that you're exactly right. The food is often individually packaged, and I want to highlight kind of two big constraints that we have. One that I'm sure you're all well aware of is the shelf-stable nature of shipping food in rural Alaska. But the bigger constraint that we oftentimes face in specifically this program are the federal requirements for nutrition. And when you combine those two, the need for product that will survive the journey from our vendor in Houston, Texas, to our neighbor in rural Alaska, and without any need for refrigeration or a cold chain, you combine that constraint with the very strict nutrition requirements from our federal government, USDA, we actually end up with a very small amount of food that we can use. And our vendor has been wonderful in making sure that we have options and the widest variety of food possible. And I want to maybe focus on this program being the value is not necessarily in the poundage efficiency of the food arriving, because it's 10 meals per child per week. But it is focused on the ability to get that food directly to the door of the child, mm-hmm. Which is something that we've never had before. So we trade off a little bit of poundage efficiency and bulk efficiency for the ability to put it right at the feet of that child.
One more quick follow-up. And I have to admit, I kind of struggle with that program a little bit. When the government or when a nonprofit is delivering something directly to a child, mm-hmm. you're bypassing the family unit. You're bypassing the family that is supposed to be providing for their children. Mm-hmm. And so I struggle a little bit with it because I think it creates a dependency, unfortunately, in the same way that in some cases free lunches in schools have provided kind of an alternate pathway, and parents have been able to somewhat step away from their duty as a parent to provide for their children. And so that was kind of why I was thinking, instead of a big box of snack foods that were all individually packaged, and not to say that it wasn't a great program, but it was short term. And people got really reliant on it. And then when it ends, they're like, oh, my gosh, how do I feed my kid? Well, you know, so I guess, like I said, I struggled with it a little bit from that perspective, if you can kind of understand where I'm coming from. But bulk foods that go directly to families as a unit, that really encourages a family, especially when they have to cook something or rehydrate something and then maybe put it in a little bag or put it in a Tupperware container and send it with their child. So I just wanted to kind of get at that a little bit more with the bulk food concept. So, but I appreciate, and I'd like to learn a little bit more about the vendor and your federal constraints.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I can respond to that as well.
Thank you, Ms. Miller.
Certainly. To the previous point about freeze-dried food, we've spoken with some of the local companies who do that, and currently the economies of scale is not at the point where it would be cost competitive for us. They are expensive and quality. Right? And so we can't, it's not really, it wouldn't be cost effective to mirror the Meals to You program with one of the local freeze-dried companies right now. Mm-hmm. We have talked a lot around what to do when we have a glut of bananas. What do we do with that? That's what food preservation is all about, is extending the lifetime of a resource. And it is something we are looking into and actively engaging with partners on, but we are always open to more specifics around that. To comment on the family, child, and delivering meals directly to children, that is something that was shown to be a need in communities, and we do not ask families to manage themselves differently. We respond to need. And so that's at the community level and how households manage themselves. It is part of the discussion. Social fabric is certainly a part of the anti-hunger discussion, and because we are so culturally rich and diverse, and Food Bank is a statewide organization, we meet the need, and that's what we have to feed kids first, with the 1 in 5 children being hungry. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean it's the solution forever. It doesn't mean it's a silver bullet. And we regularly, evaluate these programs. And internally, we're discussing, you know, what, how could these be better, and what does this mean to end, what would ending hunger look like in the state? But we're so far from that. Mm-hmm. Kids need food today.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. We have a question from Rep. Story.
Thank you, Chair Dybert. Through the chair, welcome. Great to have all this information and know what's going on in food security. Really appreciate the efforts and appreciate the community coming forward too and helping. My question has to do with the help from getting through the regulations in Washington, D.C. How frequently do you communicate with our congressional delegation about what needs to change in the regulations from Washington to understand the unique Alaska?
Thank you. Through the chair.
Ms. Miller.
We have what I would call a consistent line of communication, which each of our each office in our congressional delegation, they proactively reach out and ask us to review bill language. They ask us about potential impact. We pro-offer information. As an example, last summer during HR 1 negotiations, also known as the Big Beautiful Bill, there was much back and forth about potential impact of cuts to SNAP and then adjacent impacts, looking at cuts to Medicaid and what that would mean for our neighbors. So I would say it is a solid, consistent communication, and questions go back and forth.
Follow up? Yes, I'm through the chair. I'm pleased to hear that, and I really would encourage efforts about what regulations need to change, and I'd be curious to know what you have sent to the delegation about regulations that need to be changed, because I would love to see them so I, too, can raise an informative voice of what the bottlenecks are. I have been trying diligently to get our one licensed child care provider in Haines, Alaska, to get the federal government to do what they did during COVID, which was virtual visits 3 times a year to assure the quality of the program that this provider has been doing for over 20 years, received nutritional assistance to help provide meals, to healthy meals to her children, and you know, more off-the-road system in Haines, very expensive, and this money made a huge difference in the little salary that she gets from her families, which is significant to the families. And what we've found the bottleneck to be is there has to be, it can't be the federal government giving to the state, which they do, and the state cannot give directly to the provider. They have to give to a third party, and there is no third party. They have quit servicing Haines, and that's a tragedy to me. So anyway, I would appreciate, sorry to go a little bit off the rail there, but I would really appreciate knowing what you're advocating for so I, too, can advocate for those changes.
Great question. Ms. Miller?
Sure. Thank you for the question, through the chair. We are happy to follow up with our laundry list of the day of what is going on. And important to distinct between statutory, you know, policy and regulation. And often we have questions about regulation, and that should go to the agencies, the federal agencies, such as Food and Nutrition Services at the USDA. We are often redirected to agencies from our congressional delegation, as they are appropriators, but they often are not in the everyday detail, nitty-gritty of how SNAP works and how our programs work. So we are happy to follow up and talk more about that.
Okay. And thank you. I think we are, I'd like, before we move to the next slide, I'd like to welcome Representative Ruffridge, who joined us at 8:29. Good morning. All right, next slide. I think you touched on this a little bit. I love this program. I know when we had the COVID money, we had meals in Fairbanks that were given out at Lathrop High School right in South Fairbanks, and kids were all summer long biking up and getting their lunch bags, and it was, you know, it was really great to see the kids being fed. So I'm excited to learn more about this.
Absolutely. Thank you. So the Meals to You program began back in 2019 as a pilot from Baylor University. And traditional summer food service program, SFSP, is a program that covers children nutrition during the summer months when they don't have access to school meals. Traditionally, that program runs point in place in a community And Food Bank of Alaska works to identify sites, sponsor those sites, and ship bulk amounts of food to those communities, and they're distributed in a very patterned, metered way. To speak a little bit about bottlenecks and challenges, we have always been challenged to operate a traditional program, and in the past, we've only been able to reach about 30 communities at max with a traditional summer food service program. Mm-hmm. Meals to You offers a lifeline option for rural communities, and Senator Murkowski was a big champion of bringing this pilot program up to Alaska. Given this situation into 2020, the program was rapidly expanded to include many states, including Alaska, and ran as a pilot throughout the pandemic years. In 2023, Food Bank of Alaska was approached by Deed here in Alaska, who wanted to take this program into the demonstration phase. So it began as a pilot. It is now a demonstration, and we've been operating this program. This will be our third season this year, and we've seen the program balloon and reach more students than we ever have before in the state of Alaska. And for a little bit of context, in a normal year prior to Meals to You, the state of Alaska over the summer would serve about 200,000 meals across the entire state, across all programs. Since adding Meals to You as an option, just Meals to You alone served over 1 million meals last season. So we've been able to rapidly increase the number of meals we're able to serve. We've been able to get those meals directly to the household so that they can be utilized. We've reduced the burden of access. We've increased the number of communities we can get the food into. And we're able to provide a wider variety of food options in a way that we've never been able to do before. We've done this by reducing barriers of access, by reducing administrative burden of having to run individual sites, and we've also leveraged a really close relationship with the United States Postal Service to be able to deliver those boxes. And all of that has come together with an incredible vendor to make this possible. And again, as I mentioned, just this last season, we were able to serve over 1 million meals in the months of June, July, and August to just under 10,000 students. It's an incredible opportunity, and we're honored to be part of the demonstration program, and we're really hoping that it will move into a full-fledged option beginning after next season.
Thank you so much, Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Diver. Through the chair, when you talk about the vendor, is that the vendor that's in Texas that you're talking about? And if you could clarify that, please.
Through the chair, yes, exactly. Our vendor on the program is a company called McLean Hunger Solutions, and they're a wholesaler that specifically works with food banks to provide low-cost, high-quality services to the nonprofit sector.
Follow up?
Thank you. Through the chair, if you could help me understand how that works with the vendor, how you collaborate, just kind of how the food gets here and that whole process.
Absolutely. Through the chair, so we, given the scope of this program, we went through a federal standards bid process to identify our vendor when we started the program, and we carry them for three seasons, and we'll go through another bid. But McLean Hunger Solutions was the most experienced vendor in our bid pool. They were the ones that ran the initial pilot with Baylor University and across the handful of states that participate in the pilot. So they had the infrastructure. They bring in all the food wholesale, and then they're able to build our boxes custom. So we're able to add Alaska-specific content. We're able to work with them directly to create our custom menus. Many of the other vendors across the nation provide a single packaged meal unit that we don't get any say in what's in that unit. McLean was able to work with us to give us full customizability of the entire box. So they have developed a very close relationship with the post office. And normally when you mail a flat rate box, which is what our program comes in. It would bounce around to a couple different hubs in the lower 48 before actually making it to Alaska. In the pilot, that was the experience, and the challenge was that provided a lot of damage to the box. And we found that by the time it made it up, it took up to 2 weeks sometimes just to get to Alaska, and that there was a lot of damage. So when we brought into or when we entered into the demonstration, McLean was able to create a custom relationship with the U.S. Postal Service. They create the boxes, roll them right onto a plane, and ship them directly to Alaska so that we don't have to deal with the extra damage to the boxes incurred by bouncing around. It gives us it cuts the time for shipping in half, and it means that we have a damage rate that's below 1% on the boxes. It's really an incredible relationship.
Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Tybert, and thank you, Chair, for allowing me to be late once again. This is an interesting program, and I think I have just a couple of questions. The first, is it possible to get a list of the school districts that these go to? And that's obviously not for right this second, but maybe emailed to the Chair and to the committee. I'd be interested to see that. The second thing, and maybe I missed it in the presentation, but the meal, that goes home with children from school, or is it replacing meals at school?
Oh, yes, Mr. Reinhart.
Through the chair. So this is a summer program, and the meal boxes, each containing 10 breakfasts and 10 lunches, are mailed directly to the household, either via a street address or a P.O. box. As noted on the slide, we had 31 school districts work with us last year. As of today, we have 27 signed on for this season, and we still have a couple more weeks for them to sign on. So we'd be happy to get you over the list of who we'll be working with this season.
Okay, and then I guess a follow-up to that.
Follow-up?
So just earlier this week, we heard about the difficulty in getting food service, especially to remote areas of Alaska, due to spoilage and other things like that. I guess when you customize these boxes, what type of food is generally in there? Is it I assume it can't have food that spoils in it. So what's in the box typically?
Yes.
Through the chair.
Mr. Reinhart.
Absolutely. So our boxes meet the USDA guidelines for the program, which is our primary constraint. As mentioned earlier, we also have constraints around being able to ship shelf-stable food. So you're correct. We don't provide perishables in this box. Each box, as mentioned, contains 10 breakfasts and 10 lunch, each with a 8-ounce unit of milk. And then the food items, we focus on low or no sugar options, which is surprisingly challenging in the packaged food space. And then we split our boxes into three different menus that rotate. So the child doesn't receive the same food every week, and that's really important because if you got the same 10 meals every week, you'd be a little sick and tired of it by the end of the summer. And then we work with our vendor because Alaska has some waivers to allow us slightly different nutrition. We're allowed fewer carbohydrates and some more proteins based on cultural diet preferences. So that's why being able to customize our entire box with our vendor is so important. So we're able to add things like jerky, and we're experimenting on some options for shelf-stable bread and things that would be recognizable to a child. One of the things that our vendor is very focused on is, when possible and effective and efficient, adding brand-named items. Because oftentimes in our world, we deal in generics, and there's a dignity in providing a child with a cereal option that they recognize. Mm-hmm. And so, as mentioned, all of our cereals are low or no sugar, the milk is oftentimes referenced as one of the most popular items in our survey efforts.
I guess more. Do I have time for follow-up? Madam Chair?
We have, it looks like, about 7 more slides, and we have a hard stop at 9:30.
Oh, okay.
Just so you're,
Thank you.
So, follow-up?
So milk, that, is that powdered milk in there? How do you, what does shelf-stable milk in the box look like?
Yeah, per the USDA guidelines, we're not allowed to use powdered milk, and we have been working with our, the state office as well as USDA to see if we can get a waiver for a percentage of that milk in the future being powdered, mostly for weight efficiency. But currently, it's like an 8-ounce boxed milk, and it looks like a juice box, but it's 8 ounces of ultra-high pasteurized shelf-stable milk.
Oh, I think I've seen that. Thank you. Okay. Yeah. I'm thinking you can't send perishable food, but then milk is in the box, and I was not computing, but I think I know what you're talking about. Thank you.
It's a kind of box with a little straw glued to the side. I have plenty of those when I was a teacher, when I was rushed for food. And if that meal is a pizza, kids will eat it 3 times a week. That was their favorite meal of the day. So we do, I just want to do a time check. We have about 45 more minutes and looks like about 7 more slides. So please continue.
Wonderful. Thank you. So one of the other programs that we've referenced previously is our SNAP program. This is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It is our most, as Anthony said, effective and cost-effective and fraud-proof program in the state. 1 in 10 Alaskans access SNAP. It is critical to both urban and rural hunger. It is supplemental, as the name states, and so it is meant to supplement the household grocery line, which, as we know, with rising costs of childcare, housing shortages, the general cost of living going up, often food is your most flexible budget line in your household budget, and that's where often people will make cuts, which is why a supplemental assistance program is so critical. The formula for the amount of money that you receive of SNAP benefits is individual by individual or household by household, so it's pretty complicated. We're not going to get into it today. The Division of Public Assistance is steeped in that, so that's where I would direct you for that formula. Wanted to highlight today that outside of the Anchorage and Mat-Su area, I apologize on this slide, total SNAP, that's not redemption. That is total SNAP benefits distribution across the state. So of 100% of SNAP benefit distribution, which is $24 to $26 million a month, 63% of that is outside of Anchorage and Mat-Su. And that's from last September. The other thing we want to highlight about SNAP, and again, we have a partnership with the DPA. Our SNAP outreach team travels around the state to do application assistance for folks who maybe have trouble navigating the 28-page paper application or need some direction on the online application. There is a program that was enacted in the 1973-74 Food Stamp Act that allows SNAP benefits to be used for subsistence materials purchase, such as fishing gear. We don't have any numbers on the redemption rate of that, but it is something that is unique to Alaska and exists and probably could be better marketed around the state.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair. A couple of the members of this committee also sit on the Health and Social Services Committee. So, unfortunately, we are very interested in the DPA side of the SNAP question. You have in the picture questions about SNAP. I mean, we've had lengthy conversations with the division about workforce shortages, difficulty filling out applications. How much help are your staff members able to give members of communities on the follow-through and efforts needed to fill out those applications and get a response?
For the process, through the chair.
Yes,
thank
Ms.
you
Miller.
For the question. The process is, as an example, one of our outreach assistants would go to an outreach event. Someone would approach the table, say, I want help filling out the SNAP application, or I don't know, I need help, right? And so we walk through a variety of benefits programs, but we do SNAP application assistance specifically. And we enter the application. It goes to the DPA. Any additional follow-up from even that same person later on requires a different interaction with DPA. So we are not the DPA. We do not act that way. We are assistants to get the paperwork to the DPA.
Follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. So after the application, we heard this week in HES committee that the average time to have a response is 43 days. So, and then kind of walking through those issues with DPA, a lot of those applications end up falling through the cracks. So the food bank, once you have a person approach at a booth or something, there's not a follow-up to them to check on them or anything like that?
Not individually with the client unless they reach out to us. We have, in the last couple of years, really invested in our own technology and partnered with the Anchorage Municipality for a text-to-SNAP program. So there's a couple different ways people can reach out to us, and that's both for application assistance and status checks. So if someone, the same person came to us and did an application assistance and followed up a couple weeks later, it would be a separate interaction with the same person. And you can text to SNAP, so we are often texting back and forth with clients or email or phone call often.
And last follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you. And maybe this is a question better offline, but I'll ask it just if you have input now. What would be, if you could push a button and fix one thing with the SNAP application process, what would you fix?
Ms. Miller.
That is a big one.
Good question. Big question.
Excellent question. Yeah. I to the previous question around federal regulation from Rep. Story, I think that is key to how we can do this in this state, right? We are beholden to the regulations and policies of the federal government for the SNAP execution. If I had the biggest magic wand in the world, it would look like streamlining across programs. There are different criteria for a variety of assistance programs, and it makes it very confusing and hard not just to apply but to stay current and compliant in your applications. And so if you are on even two programs, Medicaid and SNAP, which is the biggest overlap of public assistance use in the state, you are an administrative master. You have to be. Otherwise, you get dropped from a program. And so I think to decrease the burden on our clients, and when we talk about the SNAP error rate, it is 99% not on the client. It is on an agency error, or it's a paperwork thing, right? It is a complicated system. And so I would say streamlining in criteria, streamlining in paperwork. I know that we are investing in technology in the state. So the other part of that is education for our neighbors. How do we use the tools that we are enacting across the state to make sure everyone understands what to do because they want to stay compliant?
Thank you.
Thank you for that question. And I just think about, you know, my neighbors, if it's a grandparent who recently had to take in grandchildren and like trying to go through that system. And a lot of times our grandparents, you know, they're not tech savvy, don't have the phone. And that would be a hindrance. Or if it's a mom who has, you know, three kids and trying to figure out, you know, standing in line to figure out this 28-page paper. There's a lot of issues with the program. That's a great question. And anything we can do to help these families and our neighbors. All right, next slide. Thank you, Ms. Miller.
Thank you. Through the chair, we made some space here for TFAP if there are any additional questions, though.
Yeah, looks like we have a question from Representative Freer.
Thank you, through Chair Dibert. Ms. Miller, thank you, and Mr. Reinert for being here. You spoke a little bit about the TFAP program earlier, so I won't go too far into it, but one of the things that you mentioned is that you, the number of community partners you have 70 community partners and 60 in rural Alaska, and similar to Representative Ruffridge's question, if we could get a follow-up on which communities that you serve, I would really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Great
question. Ms. Miller.
Thank you, through the chair, for that question, and we will certainly follow up with some finer details. It's also important to recognize that TFAP, this program, includes shipping and storage dollars. We spend an enormous amount of money shipping things out of our warehouse. We run our own little postal service in our warehouse, and it is quite expensive, as we all know, to get food to rural Alaska. And I'm going to turn it over to I'm going to turn it over to Anthony to talk about what that means for our annual budgeting cycle.
Mm-hmm. I guess I did want, and before we move to Mr. Reinert, I wanted to, for the record, let the record reflect that we've been joined by Rep. Underwood at 8:50. Good morning.
Right. Mr. Reiner.
Thank you. So the Emergency Food Assistance Program, often referred to as TFAP, is Food Bank of Alaska's flagship program for service to rural Alaska. When we call it a commodity program, we're meaning that we actually deal in physical poundage of food. And just a kind of a contextual point here, the federal government uses the USDA to purchase food to stabilize food markets. And when they do that, they're left with a bunch of food on hand. And that that food is then distributed out to the different states and then through Food Bank Network and other networks to be able to serve our neighbors. So we get, in Alaska, a certain percentage of the overall amount of food that is purchased by USDA. And that the total value amount is somewhere on the order of $700,000 a year. And if that doesn't sound like a lot, you're right. Mm-hmm. And then there's a separate provision in the program that we call bonus food. Section 32 bonus is the official title. And that is food that is kind of extra in the system that isn't part of our allotted $700,000. This is a little in the weeds, but I think it's important just to understand how this program works. So 80% of all the food in the Alaska TFAP program comes through the bonus side of the program, meaning that we never quite know what we're going to get or when we're going to get it. And so we deal with a lot of ebbs and flows in the program. Some months we might have six different commodities that come up to Alaska. Some months we might have one or two. And so while, as noted, the program comes with shipping and storage dollars, which allows us to get that food out to many of the rural communities that we serve, it doesn't often come with enough. On an annual basis, Food Bank of Alaska ends up covering about 30% of the cost of shipping and storage and distribution out to rural Alaska. It's a really important program, and it's, as noted, one of the only ones that does come with that shipping portion. And so, you know, that's our role to play in making sure that the program can be continued to ship and administered. It's an important program. It stands up physical food infrastructure in communities, and it's how we will continue to serve rural Alaska.
Thank you for that overview. We have a question from Representative Freer.
Thank you, Chair Dibert. Thank you again. So you said that you deal with an actual number of poundage of food. Can you tell us what the poundage is? How much you said in Alaska receives a certain percent from the rest of the United States. What percent is that? And what Food Bank of America covers 30% of cost in shipping to rural Alaska. What does that figure look like?
I can speak in big numbers. I don't have the specific exactly in front of us. Alaska's allotment out of the total TFAP program is something on the order of 0.7%. Of the total national program, so it's very small, and that is just our allotment. Like I mentioned, we do get bonus food that would change that as a total. And then you asked about the 30% cost that Food Bank takes on. I don't want to give you a wrong number, so please let us follow up on that.
Okay, thank you. And then. Sorry.
Yeah, follow up.
Through the chair, or just and the poundage, if you can.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, please continue.
TFAP dovetails very nicely into our disaster preparedness and response. Again, with it being our biggest program that we're able to serve rural Alaska with, that means there is a network already established that we can leverage in times of disaster, which unfortunately we have recently seen with Typhoon Halong and previous to that, Murbach. So I'll turn it again over to our chief programs officer, who was elbow, knee, hip deep in whatever was going on last year.
Mr. Reinert.
Thank you. Food Bank of Alaska plays an integral part in our emergency response network. We are a member of the Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, or VOAD, group. We also work directly with the State Emergency Office of Coordination, the SEOC, to make sure that food and water flow throughout the state where it's needed. We've just had a very visceral experience, as noted, with Typhoon Halong and its devastating impacts in Western Alaska. We work closely with our partners in Bethel, as well as downstream to 24 or so communities that are currently continue to experience the impacts of the disaster. Because of our connection, as noted, with Feeding America, Feeding America also works on a national disaster level. And as we were planning and preparing for Typhoon Halong, we got spun up two containers of emergency food boxes, as well as three containers of bottled water. And you can see some photos of that here in the slide, absolutely turning our warehouse into a swimming pool, as we call it, with all the bottled water we brought up. We, to this day, continue to distribute those resources out to communities in Western Alaska. And it has been a rocky process to make sure that all this makes it out to where it needs to be. The challenges in this space are many, and I want to highlight two in particular. On a regular basis, Food Bank of Alaska and our network of voluntary organizations are called upon to respond to emergencies, and I use that word very particularly. There are many situations that, if anywhere else in the nation, would rise to the level of a disaster, and for a number of reasons, they do not. Disaster as a legal definition allows a lot of resources to be allocated and used in serving and preserving our communities when they face disaster. But an emergency situation doesn't come with the same resources. And so these range from breakup flooding in the spring to fire evacuations in the summer to a new category of challenge, which is infrastructure issues throughout our communities, things like water systems freezing or power systems going down at any time of the year. And when the state resources have not been declared, then responding to those emergencies falls upon our network, including Food Bank of Alaska, Salvation Army, Lutheran Social Services, Catholic Social Services. And Food Bank of Alaska, as we do have a core competency in shipping and logistics, often plays the central role in collecting, organizing, palletizing, and shipping those resources to the community without state support. So that continues to be an emerging challenge to find the resources to consistently and regularly respond in those situations.
Okay, Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Can you talk about the, I get that disaster and emergency have different legal definitions for a lot of things, but how does that impact our ability to, for Food Bank's ability to provide response? So if you could like give a little bit more context to what can a food bank do when there's a disaster declaration versus an emergency declaration?
Great question. Thank you. Mr. Reinhart.
Through the chair. Thank you. There's a lot of ways to look at this challenge. And I think what I would note is without the resources dedicated in a disaster, we are, one, scraping food and resources from other programs to be able to try to cobble together our response as opposed to having a dedicated response. The other piece, as we've discussed already and all well know, is the cost and challenge of logistics into rural Alaska, depending on where the emergency is. We could be anywhere from 56 cents a pound to $2.50 a pound as we face currently in Kipnuk, Alaska. And when you start to look at rate to destination, that $2 to $2.50 a pound, we just shipped $10,000 worth of bottled water to Kipnuk, and that got us a whole 2.5 pallets of water to the community. So the consumption rates, and you multiply that by the cost of getting it there, sometimes become overwhelming. And so while our communities are experiencing sometimes a devastating emergency, we're caught trying to figure out how to find the money and the resources to send it to them, and that creates tragic delays. More than once or twice, Food Bank has been kind of left in the lurch by shipping partners or relationships that didn't ultimately pan out to cost of those situations.
Yes.
Follow-up comment. Mm-hmm. Thank you. To build on what Anthony is saying, something that we learned last fall during the government shutdown, when there was a SNAP gap, people didn't receive their SNAP benefits across the nation, food banks and pantries were filling that gap for folks, which, again, per my previous comment about SNAP being most impactful, for every meal the food bank network puts out, SNAP can provide 9. So that gap was existing during the government shutdown. What that meant was the entire the national food bank supply chain was drawn down, and it was extremely stressed. And as we all know, we are at the end of the road and beyond. We're the last stop on shipping. And so we were very concerned about delays, and not just delays, but quantities. Were there going to be adequate quantities available? Something that we have talked about is one of the challenges in responding to disaster is being adequately prepared to efficiently and quickly respond. And Anthony has a great pipeline analogy about making sure that, you know, it's harder sometimes to get going every time, like a diesel engine, right? It is harder to you can chug along rather than just ignite every time. And so I'll save those are the analogies I brought today. But it's important to recognize that often funding will come with a spend down timeline. And so a disaster happens, we receive an enormous amount of support, but often there's requirements to spend that money down with a certain amount of time for said disaster, understandably so. It means we have to start everything again when the next disaster happens, which makes it's the same process, and we could be more efficient and better preparing in the state.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. This is the last topic we'll talk about today, and wanted to talk a little bit about our new Food is Medicine program. So earlier this year, there was an RFP that came out from the Department of Health for a produce incentive and food is medicine resource and coordinating agency. It's a rough acronym, but that's our title. And what this RFP was requesting was an entity in the state willing to engage in this space to facilitate, again, statewide collaboration, take pulse on what is happening with food as medicine, and we'll talk about that term in a second, and get into communities, provide technical assistance to figure out how to maximize nutrition incentive programs like SNAP, like WIC, like these CSFP or senior boxes. And there's been a lot of questions today, and we field many of them about fresh food access. We know that's a critical component to being nutritionally complete, and we know it is really hard to do to get access consistently to fresh food across the state. A couple reasons that we know this program or this concept is needed in Alaska is 1 in 7 Alaskans are food insecure, and that is a contributing factor to or chronic disease is a contributing factor to food insecurity and vice versa. So we have some big numbers in chronic disease to reckon with in this state. And it's a huge public health cost. Nationally, it's $5 trillion that we spend. 90% of that is spent on chronic disease management and mental health issues. And so there is a high price tag on not having access to fresh food. So we entered into a partnership with the state of Alaska for the next 10 years to be this produce incentive and food as medicine resource and coordinating agency. And we'll be working closely to understand what we can do in the state. So we really kicked off our work in May of 2025. Just a couple weeks ago, we released this study, the Nutrition Incentive and Produce Prescription Food as Medicine Statewide Landscape Assessment, talking about programs in Norton Sound, talking about YK Health and produce box models that have worked before in the state. And your questions today have already shown that we all understand it is difficult to consistently access fresh food year-round, and there are compounding challenges in how people access that economically, and we've seen that produce prescription programs are a creative way that have worked in many other states to get people access to food. And so a healthcare provider would screen someone for a variety of conditions, and increasingly there are food insecure criteria that healthcare providers, from emergency services to palliative care to hospice, are asking. To my knowledge, we do not have a consistent set of that criteria across the state, which would be helpful in streamlining the amount of people who could be better served by these programs. So that's what this landscape assessment talks about. The next couple months are going to be about strategic planning for our group and taking a concerted, an intentional effort and moved forward with healthcare providers in the state, nutritionists, anyone who has a vested interest in increasing demographics access to fresh food. 5 months ago, we started a modest but powerful pilot project called Growing Hope. And we are packing 20, this is a box up here on the screen, 20 boxes a week of fresh, ideally local and organic food. It turns out from our preliminary data collection that our eaters value local over organic. And these boxes are going to people who are in cancer treatment centers. Our goal is to grow this program. We have received many requests to serve a variety of demographics, including seniors, people in palliative care, and the other ones that I mentioned earlier. It's an exciting program. It is cool to see. We're getting pictures of people, you know, making meals, and this is supplemental for them. There's a woman who volunteers every week in the food bank, and she also receives one of these boxes, and we regularly get feedback on them from her, and it's a positive program. And so we will be planning for the next 9 years of how to increase access to fresh food, ideally through produce prescription. The one thing I wanted to mention was, as we look at the Rural Health Transformation Program funding, and some of you may be familiar with the Medicaid 1115 waiver process, food as medicine is a tool that we could use in that program. And the state is still in the process of figuring out how and when to apply for that 1115 waiver. But that would allow us to get a program set up for Medicaid billing. We would have the codes in place so that providers could refer patients to receive a box of produce as if it were a prescription, and Medicaid dollars could pay for that. That is not new. Other states are doing that, and it's something that Alaska could leverage. The last point I'll make is programs like this for food as medicine are reliant on a robust supply chain that gives us access to fresh food. And so this program will work better if we can make a more robust food system in the state. We currently do not have enough growers to grow enough food to meet our demand as Alaskans in general. And so that is that we are part of our food system. We're not just recipients. We're demand. We're part of the market.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Divert. Mm-hmm. So through the chair, I want to like this idea, but I have kids, and kids don't like produce, and frankly, neither do adults. For example, McDonald's tried salads for a few years, and then the CEO of McDonald's said, we're not going to do salads anymore. Why? Because nobody buys them, and we're throwing them all away. What's the way that this program helps people integrate produce into – I think a lot of us don't know how to use produce. And so you're either stuck with a item in the box that you have no idea how to use. I've never talked to this committee about eggplants, but I don't know if anybody here knows what to do with an eggplant. Okay. Representative Carrick does. I do not. I wouldn't know what to do with half the things that probably come in the box. And so you look at it and you say, I want to eat that, but I have no idea how to. How does this help people not throw half the things in the box away?
Thank you for that question. Through the chair, you and everyone else is asking this question because we all understand that Brussels sprouts are tough, right? We had a funny instance. We had our produce delivery a couple weeks ago, and one of our warehouse workers received the food and checked everything off, and there was something missing. And I said, what happened? Why didn't we catch this? And, you know, he was like, I grew up here. I don't know what fennel is. Like, it was just there is a general lack of awareness. Also, you should roast your eggplant. It's delicious.
Thank you.
So what we've done for this specific program program because this pilot is serving people in cancer treatment. There is a cookbook by the American Cancer Society, and it's divided by symptom or you know, an issue that would arise from getting treatment. And so there are recipes that align with the foods that we use. So we offer – everyone received a book in that program. And we offer, we highlight recipes every week. We change the produce every week. We get feedback every week from folks asking for, you know, I'd like more fruit. I'd like more vegetables, garlic. Things need to taste good. Point blank, right? Everyone needs to eat food that tastes good. And so we're looking at herbs. The soup mix, the dehydrated soup conversation from earlier has come up in this conversation around how to make those vegetables last a little bit longer for folks. And so spices, we need to spice our food. So that we are paying attention to that and getting feedback, but you cannot just offer vegetables without a little bit of guidance. And the other part of that is, even if you know how to cook, to your point earlier, Rep. Dibert, if there is a mother of three, cooking takes a ton of time, right? So that is something we are also exploring in how to decrease that burden. The other part of this is the social behavior and normalcy of cooking for some folks, right? You're going through cancer treatment, and the folks who do have the energy to cook, it's a little thing that they can do. They don't have to go to the store, but they can make their own meal or their caregiver. These boxes are packed such that they can support 2 to 4 people a week. So caregiver wellness is equally as important as patient wellness in this program.
Okay, thank you for that. And I know, like, when I'm not feeling well or if I'm sick, soup is the best thing. And if you have access to moose or caribou, my grandma used to make rabbit stew, it's the best. You know, you could take what's in here and then make a big pot of soup and either share it or, you know, save it in some way. So that kind of goes back to the preservation and the importance of just educating. It's a lot of educating. So, yes.
To respond to that, thank you for that comment. Food is culture, food is community, food is our history, and it is our future. It is not just kale, right? We're not just eating lettuce and calling it good. Food is integral to everything that we do, and everybody eats, which means everybody can understand these programs. To your point about moose, one of the really exciting things we can do with this concept in this state is Alaskify it, right? So we know that vegetables are good, but what do we actually eat up here? And we, a couple months ago, kicked off the Food is Medicine Coalition, statewide network that we are still building of, again, healthcare providers, anybody working in the food system, because it takes our entire supply chain and healthcare chain to make something like this happen. What does Food is Medicine mean for us? What does it mean to incorporate and highlight traditional foods in this program? So we are actively having that conversation. It's not for us, as I said earlier, it's not for us to define. It's for Alaska to define. And here we go. We're on the way.
Beautiful. Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. I really appreciate the, you know, this last half. I think that building sustainability for families and rural Alaskan food security is really where we need to be going. And I traditionally, the food bank in my mind has always been a place where people can go to fill a gap when they're having trouble and not completely replace the food model for a family. If you've ever been to rural villages, the smaller, you'll find that spices are not a big thing, whether it's whitefish in the oven or it's dry meat. But it kind of highlights that point of vegetables are great for some things, but if you look at traditional diets, they're very high in protein and healthy fats. So I hope that maybe the program can start to look at that. But my question is about the program. You had kind of mentioned, so the timing, I'm kind of curious on the funding. You said that you started a program, your 10-year partnership with the state. So obviously that's already started. And I'm kind of curious, the program that you mentioned, the healthy program, I wondered if you could mention, is this a federal grant that kind of started this or precipitated the 10-year partnership, the Food is Medicine? And then how is this going to tie in potentially with, I'm assuming that the food bank is interested in applying for the Rural Health Transformation Fund grant in some way, shape, or form to try to figure out how to build this capacity because the goal is to create healthier families and healthier bodies going forward. It's not just solely to purchase food and put it in people's homes. So if you could expand on that, that would be great.
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Miller.
Through the chair. All great points, excellent questions. I would love to see you at a coalition meeting. These are the things we're actively talking about. I think that we're talking about moving from a proactive or from a reactive model to a proactive model. And sometimes we talk about that as shortening the line at the food bank. Right now we feed the line, right? And so we need to get fewer people in that line, and you know, increasing positive health outcomes through access to food is a way to decrease that in the long term. Short term, we have people we need to feed every day, but this is a smaller but more, you know, intentional long-term approach. For the overlap of, so this money, first of all, is from the CDC. Okay. It's coming through Department of Health. It is for 10 years. It is $750,000, which is not a lot of money to do all of the things that we aspire to do and that have been tasked to do. So there will be, we are looking for supplemental funding. If the state, you know, as collectively, we need to decide how we are prioritizing food security and health through food access in the state. There are a variety of ways to do that. RHTP funding is, should be a part of that formula. We have, you know, I know the state is working to get out the specifics of how to apply. The RHTP parameters, we are not allowed to spend money to buy meals directly. However, if we are piloting, it is a pilot material, is my understanding. And so as long as there is a sustainability function to these, whatever we're pitching in RHTP, it has to eventually be able to pay for itself or sustain in some fashion without RHTP funding after it expires after 5 years. Well aware. I believe this will likely be a public-private solution, as many of the things pitched in the RHTP are. It's going to take a lot of people to make this happen.
Thank you.
Thank you. I love your word, Alaskify it. And when I think of RHTP, like maybe, you know, creating an Alaska cookbook where rural communities highlight foods from their different areas on how they can integrate help from food bank and from their communities, that would be amazing. That's what I'm just kind of formulating in my mind. But maybe further discussions on the web or the Zoom meetings. You said, did you mention coalition?
We do. We have a monthly coalition meeting
that anyone can go to.
Mm-hmm. It is open. We also have a listserv. If you don't want to do any homework, we can just keep you updated.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. And yeah.
Just to follow up on that, your distributed cookbooks would be amazing, and we have some examples of that. ANTHC's Store Outside Your Door program has been an amazing resource for showing people easy access to all different types of subsistence foods preparation, and it's got to be a yes and. If you have increased access to vegetables, how can we use these and Alaskify it and regionalize it?
Thank you. It is 9:23. Any final thoughts before two? All right. Well, thank you. I think we're ahead of schedule, so that's good. Thank you so much for being here today. I know my food bank in Fairbanks is Beacon in our South Fairbanks in our community and feeds a lot of folks and takes care of us. So I just thank you for being here. Thank you for your great presentation and all the work you do to help keep Alaskans fed across the state. And I look forward to further discussions on the solution of food security. That completes the agenda for our meeting today. Again, a big thank you to Ms. Miller, Mr. Reinhart. My office will be in touch with you. I think we are going to transmit some emails and information to the committee members. And I will be in contact with all of you for a schedule for next week. The time is 9:22 a.m. and this hearing is now adjourned.